In the matter of SLW versus New Jersey Division of Pension and Benefits, may we please have appearances?
Honorable Chief and Associate Justices of the New Jersey Supreme Court, good afternoon. My name is John F. Phillips, Jr. I represent the petitioner appellant, SLW.
Good afternoon and welcome. Mr. Phillips.
May it please the court, the issue before us today involves the interpretation and application of NJAC 17:4-3.7A, which both the Office of Administrative Law and the Appellate Division found to preclude my client, SLW, from entitlement to survivor benefits under the pension law. I respectfully suggest that this administrative regulation can be viewed in one of two ways, substantively and evidentiary. Substantively, we respectfully submit that it imposes a qualification or penalty neither addressed nor envisioned by the legislature, and therefore it must be viewed as an exercise of legislative, not administrative, prerogative. I would respectfully suggest to the court that the United States Supreme Court had a similar issue before it, and that is the case of Ragsdale versus Wolverine Worldwide, 535 U.S. 81, which I cited in my brief, but only via reference to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. In that matter, the Department of Labor had enacted regulations that imposed a sanction if the employer did not inform the employee of her eligibility to take FMLA benefits. They would not be counted toward her entitlement. And there were a number of courts that found that that was an ultra vires exercise of legislative prerogative by the Department of Labor. In the Ragsdale case, the United States Supreme Court analyzes the issue from three perspectives, and I think those three perspectives are genuine in this matter before the court. The first analysis was whether the legislative intent of the FMLA was to impose a per se disqualification, or whether the congressional intent was to have a case-by-case analysis of the situation. The Supreme Court found that the conspicuous absence of any indication within the statutory scheme of a penalty, such as not informing the employee of FMLA entitlement, thereby did not require those days used to be counted toward her FMLA entitlement, was improper. I think the same applies in the case before you. The second analysis was that there was no showing for a per se disqualification. The United States Supreme Court found that a per se disqualification is appropriate in some circumstances. Here, the state has not made an argument relative to the per se disqualification or the reasons for a per se disqualification. And I reference it as a per se disqualification because, according to the regulation, as was interpreted and applied below, failure to declare a dependent on the tax returns of the pensioner was a fatal flaw to her entitlement. That, I respectfully submit, is a penalty, if not a disqualification, and more importantly, it imposes a term not envisioned by the statute, because in all other respects, SLW has met the statutory standard.
Let's talk about the statutory standard.
Yes, Your Honor.
The Appellate Division agreed that dependency is to be read into it. Tell us your position on that.
I do not disagree with the Appellate Division's determination concerning dependency. Dependency is a component of, I think, the legislative scheme. How do you prove the dependency? The Appellate Division, and very ironically, the Appellate Division...
Where does it come from? Can you look at the statute and tell us where the dependency requirement in the statute can be found? I'm looking at the definition for child under section 21.
Your Honor is quite correct. There is no statutory reference to dependency, as I see it. A child shall mean a deceased member or retirement's unmarried child, she was unmarried, of any age, whether it's 5, 35, 65, who at the time of the member or retirement's death is disabled because of an intellectual disability or physical incapacity. There's already been a determination by the Pennsylvania Board of Workers' Comp that she is permanently disabled and permanently incapacitated, is unable to do any substantial gainful work because of the impairment, and the impairment has lasted or can be expected to last for a continuous period of not less than 12 months. Your Honor is absolutely correct, and in that regard, the position of pensions seems to have grafted a requirement that was not set forth or envisioned by the legislature.
So this is not a trick question. Is there any limitation at all with regard to dependency as you understand the law?
No. But do I think that it's unreasonable? No. I don't think that that's unreasonable, but I'm not the legislature.
But let's take an example. I'm sorry, Chief, go ahead.
So that would make sense if you have a 23-year-old who from a young age lived in the household, had a disability, and was supported by the family. It makes perfectly good sense. What about a situation where someone retires at age 55, God bless them, lives till age 80, passes then and leaves behind a 55-year-old child who suffered a disability at work the year before and is otherwise financially secure? Would that person be covered and eligible for a pension under the statute as you understand it?
Yes.
And suppose, in addition, parent and child had no contact for decades because of family discord, also covered under the statute?
As the legislature defined the statutory definition of child, yes.
Could one argue that those sorts of cases suggest that reading of the statute would lead to absurd results?
In those hypothetical, yes. I would suggest that that may be sustainable, depending upon what the facts are and the factual situation.
Indeed, you know, with people living longer, let's say the retiree lives to be 95 and has a 75-year-old child, and that child has an infirmity of senior years, is well off, doesn't need additional money, you would end up devoting resources to that individual who had been perfectly able and, in fact, working all those years simply because their parent, his or her parent, happens to have lived a long time. That could be resources devoted at the expense of other retirees. Do you think that is a fair result?
In answer to Your Honor's question, the public policy of this state has been set by the legislature. The legislature has decided in its wisdom that the services of law enforcement and or firefighters are of such significance and of such value that they will provide for the coverage of a surviving child who meets their statutory definition. That has to be given credence. There are many statutes that I personally disagree with relative to fairness or public policy, but that's not the prerogative of an attorney. The prerogative, and in fact, it's not even the prerogative of the Supreme Court in terms of defining what that public policy would be.
It's up to the legislature to create classifications. They may be less than perfect. They may not capture every scenario. But even in a case where, I guess, a parent no longer has a relationship with the child, there still might be the public policy that it's better for 20% to go to the child than that the child should go on public assistance. I mean, so there There are other public policy factors that can be seen.
That is correct. And in fact, I think that the questions that were posed here are extremely important and that also concern the justices on the United States Supreme Court and the Ragsdale decision, because the Ragsdale decision said these issues really are to be addressed on a case-by-case basis.
So distinguish your case from the hypotheticals that the court presented.
In this particular case, my client did have a relationship with her father. That relationship was where the father did provide for her following her accident in the course of her law enforcement duties. Without that continuous aid, and in fact, without that continuous aid today, she's really desolate. She has no means of income. So now the question is, did the legislature intend to protect children of all ages, provided that at the time of the retiree's death, that they were disabled, permanently, totally disabled? Or do we just say, hey, the world is a hard place, go fend for yourself, see whatever subsidy that you can get?
In your case, where she lived apart for quite a period of time before this issue while disabled, should there be some modicum of proof that some checks that indicated the father was taking care of, since he seemed to be living apart, would in this particular case, not where she was living at home the entire time?
That is correct. They did live separate and apart, but
should there be some proof of that there was what you just stated, the father was supporting her?
Well, now that leaves, in terms of a practicing attorney, how do I present that proof? Obviously, I can't present father to give testimony.
How about checks?
But I can present mom, and I can present the child, and they have come forth with, I think, sufficient evidence and sufficient showing of proof, which is corroborated by her tax returns, which is corroborated by her accountant, who basically said there was no other income that she was receiving through this time except for some means, and both mom and daughter says, yeah, that means was dad. So dad was the one who supplied it to me.
Let's go back to where we started the argument. Why do you believe you need to present those proofs in light of how the statute reads? Are you conceding something that you don't need to?
I was erroneously conceding something that I don't need to concede, and you're absolutely right, Your Honor. The statute, I mean, my argument had always been from day one of my representation of this lady was that she meets the statutory definition, and that the administrative agency, notwithstanding the empowerment by the legislature to enact rules and regulations necessary to accomplish the purposes of this act, notwithstanding that vague empowerment, because that was the same vague empowerment that was given to the Department of Labor in the FMLA case of Ragsdale. But in this particular situation, she meets the statute. And I really do hate to say the interest of justice, because that's somewhat of a vague term, but the interest of justice does warrant that if there is an appropriate entitlee of these pension benefits, that it is SLW in light of these circumstances. And I think that in all other respects, the per se imposition case non-consideration, that is to say the addressment of all the other proofs that were proffered on behalf of SLW on the basis that the tax returns does not show a dependent status, is suspect and is inappropriate, improper. I also would point out one other problem, and it's a problem, I think, and it's logically consistent. The appellate division properly concludes, in light of Metro Media versus Directory Division of Taxes, the six factors outlined as to when rules should be promulgated, basically says this whole issue of an emancipated child has to be addressed through rulemaking. Well, was the rule that's involved, the subject rule that we're focusing upon, 17:4-3.7, was that envisioned with the unemancipated child in mind, only or with both the unemancipated and emancipated child. And the reason why I say that is because, and you take a look at the expert report from the tax preparer that we had submitted below, she says that under these circumstances, dad could not take daughter as a dependent under the Internal Revenue Code because they were not living together in the same house. But they could take it as a surviving relative or a supporting relative.
Well, is there anything in that regulation that suggests the dependency proof that's required there applies in a child situation?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Is there anything in 174-3.7 that talks about that proof of dependency applying to a disabled adult child under the D subsection that you're claiming under for your client?
That's my argument, Your Honor. That's my argument exactly.
The legislature has spoken about dependency in other situations for spouses and so forth, correct?
And in fact, that would always be the easiest scenario. If the child has not been emancipated, whoever is entitled to take the child as a tax deduction under a property settlement agreement would take the child as a tax deduction. It's not a real... It's really not a tremendous burden upon the retiree. What do you do in this situation where the child was emancipated and then became infirmed? And especially complicated in this matter. And
isn't the point of Metro Media to give the regulated public notice of the obligations or requirements that are necessary to be met to fall or comply with the scheme that the agency is implementing?
And that was what was so frustrating at the beginning of this case, because no one in the division was able to supply either SLW or me mm-hmm. with an explanation referencing any citation. When push came to shove, and the matter was finally brought before the Board of Trustees for PFRS, they decided, well, send it to the Office of Administrative Law and let them address what the situation was. Mm-hmm. We all know how the ALJ made the recommendation. Mm-hmm. The board accepted the recommendation, but that's putting the cart before the horse. And in fact, that was one of my substantive due process arguments mm-hmm. because you are required to comply with the law provided the law is reasonably clear. And I know that the cases that I cited dealt with criminal statutes, and I understand that. But I think that the same has to be applied in a common sense situation here. If no one knew what the game was, they were basically making the rules as the game proceeded.
Right.
I think that's inherently improper. I think that offends due process.
Well, it may offend Metro Media, which speaks directly to that issue.
Oh, it does offend Metro Media. And in fact, now we have to question, what was the intent of that regulation to begin with?
Mm-hmm.
Did the administrative agency ever contemplate this issue? And I respectfully submit they never contemplated mm-hmm. this issue. This is a case really of perhaps first impression. Will it be of last case? No, I don't think so. But I think as it stands right now, my client should not be the one who's going to be penalized by the fact that the rules are being developed as we're going along.
Anything else you'd like to add to your argument?
No, Your Honor. I was going to make the argument relative to the notification, the notice requirement to the public. That's already been addressed. I would say and remind the court that in Brady versus Board of Review, this court made a determination that regulations which are arbitrary, capricious, unreasonable, and most importantly, the court said, inconsistent with the enabling statute or legislative policy is unenforceable. In this situation, I think it's inconsistent with the legislative policy, and it adds terms that were not addressed by the legislature and certainly does not appear to be addressed by the division prior to the presentation of this case for benefits.
Thank you.
I thank Your Honors.
Ms. Chung. Please.
May it please the court. The definition of child in the PFRS statute and other pension statutes was not drafted in a vacuum. As the board determined below, the legislature adopted a standard for children who are disabled that essentially mirrors the federal standard for disability, which encompasses dependency. This is significant because the legislature had an obvious alternative, the pension statute standard for disability retirements. The two standards differ as to the extent and the permanence of the disability at issue. They also differ as to the required proof. While the legislature required medical examinations for those applying for disability retirements, it did not do so for those applying for survivor's benefits, leaving it to the pension boards to consider how to decide these claims in a reasonable manner. In most cases, eligibility for survivor's benefits turns on marital status, age, and educational status, which are all bright-line objective tests. The pension boards needed another bright-line objective test for children who are disabled. It was sensible and reasonable for the pension boards to require such children to submit their parents' income tax returns and their own. This court should therefore hold that the proof of dependency regulation is within the board's statutory authority. This court should also affirm the finding below that SLW failed to support her claim for survivor's benefits. First, she did not submit her father's income tax returns. Second, she claimed herself as an exemption on her own income tax returns, including for 2012, the year her father died. Third, there is no finding in the record that SLW is disabled under the statutory definition of child. The agreement with the Delaware River Port Authority, which actually contested SLW's workers' compensation claim, is a settlement and not a finding of disability. As for the purported expert reports from SLW's treating physician, they do not even cite the applicable standard for disability and are essentially net opinions. Therefore, the decision below should be affirmed. Thank you.
Are you done with your opening statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the definition of child, as we discussed, has no express reference or requirement of dependency. If you look to the very next definition of parent, the legislature expressly included a requirement of dependency. Are you asking us to add that and rewrite the definition of child, which the legislature, on a topic the legislature was aware of?
No, Your Honor. There's a very clear distinction between children and parents, which is what makes the board's interpretation of the definition to encompass dependency to be reasonable. First, it's important, it's critical not to lose the forest for the trees. We're dealing with different categories of children, and dependency is implicit in the concept of a child.
But as the Chief indicated, PFRS and the definition of child, disabled child, and nowhere does it mention dependency at all. The first time you see dependency is the administrative code section, which adds it. But in the PFRS code, section D, there is nothing about child being dependent.
Yes, Your Honor. The definition of child sets out different categories of children who will qualify for survivor's benefits. The word dependent does not appear in that definition. I concede that. But again, let's remember, this is a definition of child, and children are presumptively dependent on their parents. So that is one reason why, just on a broad outline, we're talking about the definition of children. As to the very structure of the definition, there are three different categories of children who would qualify for purposes of survivor's benefits. And the very first category is children who are under the age of 18, so under the age of majority. So already, this is the construct that the legislature has. It's talking about children, number one, who are under the age of majority. Then the next clause goes to children who are 18 or above, but still in secondary school, so still in high school. And that's a slight broadening of the 18-year-old age of majority, but again, it's still presuming that the child is dependent on the parent, is living at home, is going to high school. And the last category for disabled children, must follow from the other two categories. It would be...
Wouldn't it be a reasonable interpretation of that section of statute that all the children under the statute A, B, C, and D are dependent? A, because they're under the age of 18, B, because they're enrolled in a secondary school, C, under the age of 24, and D, if they're disabled. Doesn't that suggest to you that what the legislature meant was that all the individuals defined in that section were dependent? Not that A, B, and C were automatically dependent, but D had to prove a different dependency? Doesn't that suggest to you that that would be the only interpretation of that statute?
That is the board's interpretation, Your Honor, that the definition of child is referring to individuals who are dependent on their parent.
So take your language, presumptive. If that's a legislative determination, it ends it. If the legislature, as a matter of law, has decided not to put dependents in there because they think it's presumptive, that would seemingly end the analysis, unlike in the case historically with parents and widower. They knew how to use the term dependency. Historically, they've used it in those two categories. Ever since the legislature has been using child, it has never engrafted a dependency requirement. So why should we permit the agency to do what the legislature has not?
Your Honor, the legislature is operating under the assumption that children are dependent on their parents. That is why there is no need to clarify or qualify or to add the word
dependent.
Well,
they could have done it for that, but because of any age, look, the legislature could easily have figured of any age who at the time of a member is disabled. Members of this court have given examples where the child could be 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. That's certainly had to be within the scope of what the legislature was thinking, unless we're going to presume that they were totally ignorant of these potential scenarios.
The legislature also had the case law that had been developed as to when parents are responsible, when they owe legal duties to children who are disabled before the age of majority and afterwards. And it's well established under New Jersey state law that a parent is not responsible for a child who becomes disabled after emancipation. And so...
But this could have been a public policy with respect to, I'm just talking about category D, that children falling in that category, regardless of whether or not the parent has been providing benefits, is that it's better for the funding to come through what the father was entitled to through his pension benefits to pay for that child rather than for the child to go on public assistance. Why could that not have been within the conception of the legislature in not engrafting a dependency requirement?
If a child is at risk of having to go on public assistance, then the child is dependent on somebody, presumably the parent. So again, the definition of child comes into play because we're dealing with a survivor's benefit statute. And the only parties or the only individuals who can be survivors of a PFRS retiree are the spouse and the children. And those two relationships are relationships where the retiree owes a legal duty to the spouse and also to children who have not reached the age of majority. The state is essentially stepping into the shoes of the deceased retiree. So under the board's interpretation of the statute, children who are not dependent on their parents should not be getting fiduciary funds that a child who is dependent is otherwise entitled to.
Well, there's a strong policy argument that you can advance in that regard, and you can talk about the strain that this would create on pension funds. But is that for the court to make, or should the legislature clarify the statute if that's what it intends?
We don't believe the legislature has to clarify anything here because the statute as written encompasses dependency.
Not as written. Tell us which words you're relying on.
I guess I'll just have to repeat myself. We're talking about a definition of a child. The categories at issue are all focus on dependency.
Not the fourth. Not the one that we're focused on in this case speaks about any age beyond which you've already told us the parent doesn't have an obligation to support.
Of any age is also followed by language that essentially mirrors, tracks, cites verbatim the federal standard for disability. And under federal law, you definitely have to be a dependent of your parent in order to qualify for disability.
Doesn't that undercut your argument, though? When you look at the Social Security Act, Section 402, their definition of child has expressly put in the word dependent that you're asking us to read into the statute that the legislature did not include. And yet you say the legislature looked at the Social Security Act when it was crafting this provision for benefits. It certainly would have been aware of what the Social Security Act said, and yet it didn't follow the same language.
It did not. But it also had the benefit of case law saying that children who are not dependent on their parents are emancipated, that they're not their parents' responsibility anymore. Not requiring disabled children to be dependent on their parents would not only open the floodgates to many claims being made on the system. It really...
So let's take a circumstance where the child isn't dependent because the parent doesn't have sufficient income to support the child, but the parent otherwise would want to do that. Why, under this circumstance, should the child not get the benefit of the pension? You know, many pensioners are just living hand to mouth. But on the other hand, they have earned the right to the pension benefits and have earned the right to pass those survivor benefits on to their children, even if they couldn't afford supporting their children in their life. So why shouldn't, under these circumstances, the child benefit? Are you following me?
I am following you. I guess under the facts of this particular case, SLW's father was receiving a very generous pension. So it's hard for me to follow Your Honor's hypothetical all the way because he was allegedly supporting himself and his daughter out of his pension. So I understand that there may be situations where there are retirees who have very small pensions. I can't deal with that hypothetical.
So the child should be punished because the parent earned sufficient during his lifetime to earn a substantial pension. If he didn't have a lot, it would be okay? I don't understand that argument at all.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I don't understand your argument saying that in this case, the father had a substantial pension so he could support the child. But if it was someone who couldn't because there was smaller pension, then that would be okay. They don't have to prove dependency. I don't understand that argument.
No, you would always have to prove dependency. I was just answering Justice Albin's hypothetical.
You know, most pensions aren't sufficient to support extended families. Would you agree? They're basically meant at the time for the person and his or her spouse to get by. No? Or am I mistaken? I'm not talking about these huge corporate pension benefits, okay, for the gazillionaires. I'm talking about public workers.
The pension is delayed compensation for the employee after retirement, but as to whether that pension is supposed to support families or extended families, I don't think that's the purpose of a pension.
Ms. Chung, if we don't accept your argument, and I'm not asking you to yield it, could there be circumstances where, like the hypotheticals, the statute would be read in an absurd fashion if benefits were afforded? And could the division deny benefits on that ground?
The division and the board have to apply the statutes as written, as interpreted by the courts. So however absurd the results, if the person is entitled to a pension then or survivor's benefits, that's not for the administrative agency to determine whether there are absurd results or not.
One of the canons of interpretation that the court routinely turns to is statute will not be enforced in a way that leads to an absurd result. How would that factor in? if at all?
To take at least one step back here, I understand emancipation isn't sort of before this court, but the board's position below and what the board would continue to say is emancipation is sort of an issue here in that if you have children who have been fully emancipated, they are on their own, they are responsible for their own lives, their parents owe no duties to them, that is the situation in which you would never have an absurd result. You would not have children in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s who would automatically qualify for survivor's benefits because they had become disabled after they were emancipated. That being said, if we're under the scenario that we have right now where there are no rules per se about emancipation, then the the administrative agency here is just trying to figure out a way to process these claims. And survivor's benefits, as I said, I mentioned earlier, all that the statute says is that there's a standard for disability that is not the standard that the agency regularly applies. They're trying to figure out how to deal with these claims. And the regulation here requires the submission of tax returns. I would like to just take a little tangent here to talk about the argument that there's some per se disqualification if you don't submit your tax returns. That is not a fair reading of the regulation. The regulation does not say if you fail to submit tax returns, your application will be canceled or rejected or denied. And that's in contrast to the regulation that applies for disability retirements, which does say that if you fail to provide supporting proof within 6 months, your application will be canceled. So I do not agree that there is any per se disqualification here. I'll also add that the boards are very mindful of directions from this court and from the appellate division that they need to consider the equities of individual cases, that there is a good cause exception. And so to the extent that somebody was in a situation where there were no tax returns whatsoever and there was no way that they could submit tax returns, there is an escape valve. And so this court should not accept the per se disqualification argument.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to present?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court will move on.